Are you searching for a deeper understanding of yourself and your place in the world? Do you yearn for more balance, more peace, and purpose in your life? Well, look no further than the Intuitive Revolution Podcast, your trusted source for holistic insights and intuitive guidance. I'm your host, Alicia Ferricelli, and I am ready to take you on a journey to inner peace and balanced well-being. With 16 years of experience with nutritional counseling, Jenna specializes in intuitive eating. In 2017, she began working with clients who had eating disorders. Soon after realizing that she had her own issues with food and body, including chronic dieting, emotional eating, feeling guilty, and feeling out of control around food, intuitive eating changed her life and the lives of her clients to be able to exist and have food freedom. She has previously been featured on The Balanced Dietitian, Let's Be Real 100%, My Life, My Journey, Shift in the Script, and Pursuing Private Practice. Thanks, Jenna, for coming on the podcast today. I'm so excited to learn about your nutrition journey and all the wisdom that you're going to bring us today. Again, thank you for coming on.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm very excited to talk with you.
Awesome. So your journey from struggling with an eating disorder, poor body image, and perfectionism to becoming a certified intuitive eating counselor, which is fantastic, by the way, is profoundly inspiring. Can you share more about this transformation and how it led you to specialize in intuitive eating?
Yes. It's an interesting story. let's see. So where to start? I would say, you know, I was dealing with body image stuff. It kind of felt like low grade body image stuff, like throughout my life, you know, kind of that feeling like most women have growing up and everything, that they feel their body's not good enough in some sort of way. And I dealt with a lot of chronic dieting, yo-yo dieting, and things like that. And when I was 20, I was diagnosed with something called PCOS. Are you familiar with that?
No.
Polycystic ovarian syndrome.
Okay, yeah.
And it's an endocrine disorder, a hormone disorder. And so one of the things that comes with it is that you end up putting on weight very easily and things like that. And so I was always like trying to fight with that, and the recommendations for PCOS is to try to lose weight and all of this. And so, but what ended up happening is that I would go on a diet and then do it for a while, and then I'd get tired of it, and then the weight would end up coming back, and I'd blame myself for it because that's just how we're taught, you know? And is everything okay? You have a look on your face.
Oh, no, I'm listening to you. You're good.
Oh, actually, I think my headset's just died. Okay. You can hear me still okay?
Yeah.
Like this? Okay.
Yeah.
All right. We might have to edit that part.
I'll edit that out. Yeah.
So I became a dietitian, and, you know, this was back in like 2007. And actually I did all these different kinds of jobs, that dietitians do. Like I worked in a long-term care facility. I worked with developmentally delayed children, and I worked at the WIC office, and I did all of these different kinds of things. And while those jobs all had their own kind of like interest, and like I learned different things from them, I never really felt like I found my niche. It just kind of felt like I was just doing the jobs, and not really being passionate about it. And so, so later down the road, I ended up going through this really hard period with my husband. He was cheating on me, and when I called him out on it, he decided to say it was okay to do so because I was fat. Oh. And it really like just shook me to the core. And I, you know, I felt like in order to in order to feel worthy and to be successful and all of this kind of stuff, that I had to be smaller too, in order for all that to happen. And I ended up leaving him, you know, after that, because I'm not going to be talked to that way.
Right. But good for you.
Thank you. But I, but it still sat with me that whole time. And I was still, like, as I was mourning the relationship and things like that, I felt like the only way to get my life back on track and to find a partner who cared about me and to feel successful in my job, that I had to be smaller too. And so I put myself on this really crazy restriction. I was even crazier than anything that I would ever recommend to any of my people. It was kind of a take off of low carb, but it was no carb. And everything had to be made at home. I really couldn't go and eat at other places. And if I was exercising, I pushed myself to levels that weren't safe. Like the heart rate zone, I was the top of the danger area, because I felt like if I did less than that, like the place that it says was the good heart rate zone, that I wasn't working hard enough. And I did this for a while. And my body did end up changing. But what I ended up finding is that it really didn't actually end up addressing what I was hoping for. And it came with a whole laundry list of other things. Like, I became obsessed with food. I only felt good about myself if somebody complimented me, or maybe I caught a glimpse of myself in the mirror, and that was very fleeting. It only lasted maybe like a couple minutes, and then my inner critic had a party in my head about how it wasn't enough, you know?
Yeah.
And the guys that I was dating, they actually just treated me like crap. And they pretty much were just using me. And the things with my feeling successful, I still felt very insecure about my work and all of this. And so it was really weird, because I thought that this was going to be the answer, but it really wasn't. And I even had a friend tell me at one point that I didn't look well. And it was really confusing, because my, you know, I was using the body mass index as my marker of success. And my BMI was still technically in the overweight category. And I was like, that's weird. How can I not be well and still be in the overweight category? I still got a crap ton of weight still to go, you know? And, but now looking back at those pictures, I could see I really didn't look well. And, so that was interesting. And it kind of got to this point in time, kind of my wake up moment, so to speak. It was my birthday and it was Thanksgiving, and I made all of the recipes to match my restriction. Some of them came out good and some of them did not. But one of them that did not come out good was my birthday cake. It was awful.
No carbs at all in your cake?
What's that?
No carbs? In a cake?
I tried using almond flour instead of wheat flour, and those don't behave the same way.
Right.
So, this cake, it did not deserve to be called a cake. It was just this weird goo that didn't set up right. It was weird and gross. But I still forced myself to have it, because I was like, well, I wanted to have birthday cake. This is my birthday, you know? Yeah. And at that point, I was just like, okay, you know what? I'm just going to give myself the holidays off, and I'll come back January 1st and get started with the whole thing again. And then January came and I didn't want to do that anymore. You know, it was too much. It was too restrictive. I didn't want to put myself through giving up carbs again. And so I kind of let myself be a little loosey-goosey for a while. There was still restrictions in certain ways, but it wasn't as restrictive as I had made it before. But then I ended up getting this position at a drug rehab center. And it turned out that a lot of the folks there ended up having having very bad relationships with food. They, when they came off their drugs or alcohol, they either resorted to significant restriction, or they, or because they hadn't really been eating much before, they ended up, you know, resorting to like comforting and refeeding their bodies and things like that. And some of them did have diagnosed eating disorders. And at the time, I didn't have a lot of experience helping people with that. So I did some research and I found out that intuitive eating is a really successful approach. And so I started reading the book by Evelyn Trivoli and Elise Rush. And the crazy thing is that while I had my clients in mind, as I'm reading this book, it felt like they wrote the book about me. Like every little part of it, it was like they were speaking directly to me. And even though I had gone through that whole period of like that restrictive time, I didn't think it was a problem. You know, it was just dieting. It's what our society normalizes as what we're supposed to do, especially for people in bigger bodies. I didn't think it was an issue. Of course, it left me with a whole bunch of crap to deal with afterwards, but I thought it was normal. So as I'm reading this book, I'm realizing, no, this is not normal. And this is not healthy and things like that. And it finally made everything make sense. It made it make sense of like how, like why diets don't work, why we feel guilty with our food, like why we have this mean inner critic in our head, the food police voice, that tries to like make us feel a certain way, and then we rebel against that voice, and all of that, everything just lined right up. And it was just like this huge light bulb moment for me. And then as I'm also understanding this, I'm like, wow, so many people deal with this same thing and think that it's normal. And we don't have to live like that. We can actually change that and feel better in our bodies and feel better about our food and not have this constant battle all the time. So once I finished reading the book, it was like this moment that I knew this is what I was supposed to do with my life. That not only was I supposed to heal my own self with food and body, but I was also supposed to bring this to other people. And so shortly after that, I became certified in it. And I worked on my own journey. I worked with some really amazing intuitive eating professionals to help me dive through all of this messaging that I've received over the years. And that was 7 years ago, and I'm in a much different place now than I was back then. And so now and that's what I work on with my clients, is helping them navigate this and reframing those messages that really end up being harmful. So
yeah, it's really sad. And actually previous podcast to this one I was recording yesterday, we're kind of getting into a little bit about that, how society You're supposed to be a certain, look a certain way, be a certain way.
Yeah.
Yet it's so unhealthy. You know, yeah. It's like on the, you're looking at the BMI thing is like people with so much muscle are still, they're considered fat. Mm-hmm. You know, fat by, I'm not saying fat by societal standard, you know, that's such a horrible word for any, but it's, yeah, it's horrible.
It is. And there's actually some really sketchy history of how they came up with those numbers and that terminology. I'd be happy to share about that. So,
yeah, go for it. We'd love to hear that. I'm sure my listeners would as well.
So it started like in the late 1800s. There was this man who was over in Europe, and he actually wasn't in the health field at all. He was a mathematician, and he liked playing with numbers. So, and I believe what I've also been reading more about is that he was trying to do something for his country to help his country stand out. So he decided to like group people based on this number. And so the number wasn't necessarily intended to look at individual people as their markers of health. It was actually just to group people into different categories. That's all that it was.
Okay.
So there was really no like health thing attached to it. But the thing was about his grouping and his data collection is that the only people that he measured were other white European males like himself.
Oh, that's interesting.
He never measured women. He never measured people of other cultures or races or people from other countries. He just measured white European males like himself and created this whole thing that started this whole thing.
Wow.
And fast forward about 50 years-ish or so, the life insurance companies decided to make up their own height and weight tables. And their thing was is that if somebody crossed this arbitrary line, that meant that they were going to die sooner. So, but the thing was with their data collection, they only used their cherry-picked clientele. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't based off any research that was happening at the time. And if you think about it, they're a business, right? So if they draw this line in the sand, that meant that they could charge people past that line more money, or they could deny them care altogether.
Right.
And there was actually this really big study that was happening around the same time at the National Institutes of Health. They looked at about 500,000 men and women, and they looked at all different aspects of their life that could potentially affect their life expectancy. They found out that the life insurance tables were as much as 50 pounds off.
Wow.
And the people who had the highest risk of dying sooner were actually the people in the BMI 17 to 21. The underweight to quote-unquote normal weight category. The people who had the lowest risk of dying sooner were actually the ones who were in the bigger bodies. Yes,
wow,
exactly.
That's interesting.
Yes, exactly. But for whatever reason, probably because money or whatever, we were using more of the life insurance tables as those markers. Yeah. And more recently, like within like maybe the past 10, 15 years or so, something else that happened that was really ridiculous is that the numbers, the ranges of for each category, the one that was the normal weight, that one used to be higher. It used to be like 25.9, if I'm correct. Yeah, 26 used to be the overweight line. Overnight, they changed it. And then it became a lot lower. And so all of these people overnight became overweight. And so, you know, so the thing is that this is really sketchy history of,
yeah,
how this all goes. And our medical community and our health, or our society in general, the diet culture industry, they're very closely intertwined with each other. And it's a $70 to $80 billion industry every year. Wow. And they're
billion,
they're
not million, but billion.
Yes. They are out to make money off of our insecurities.
Yeah.
And just like any other business out there, they like repeat clientele. And so these things that they try to do to help people with weight loss, no matter what it is, it's designed to fail. It's designed to fail because they want people to stop doing whatever they're doing, take the blame on themselves, saying, oh, I didn't have enough willpower. The weight's going to come back. They're going to come running back to the place and say, oh, please help me, you know? Yeah. And it's this constant battle, yeah, back and forth about trying to fit into this particular size, and things like that. So there's a lot of money that's involved here, and it's not necessarily for what our benefit is, you know? Yeah.
And then you take celebrity, you take all the society, like the vanity portion of it, and the money that's being made from that.
Exactly.
As you know, in addition to, it's just, yeah.
Exactly. And
it's horrible.
You know, like, I don't know if you resonate with this at all, but I know that, like, when my favorite celebrities pass away earlier than what I think, like, I get so sad and disappointed and things like that. And it's like, why? They had so much life in them, you know? But these folks, they put their bodies through so much, so many restrictions, so many weight loss attempts and things like, yeah, that. They a lot of them do have their own eating disordered eating ways, and it's no wonder that these people die off so early, because they really put their bodies through so much torture.
And the mental stress.
Say that again?
And the mental stress that they go through, the image they, exactly, have to uphold. And it's like, I could, yeah.
Exactly. And we all look to them like that's what we're supposed to get to. That's how our, we're supposed to, in order to be successful, in order to have that glamorous lifestyle or whatever, we have to do what they're doing in order to do that. But maybe
it's photoshopped.
Yeah.
It's not even real.
Exactly. Or they actually, because they do have loads of money and things like that, they have the staff to be able to achieve that. You know, they can have the chef, they can have the personal trainer, they, yeah, can do all of this stuff that maybe a majority of people don't have the ability to do. So,
and then you look at the end of their life, were they truly happy? Were they truly joyful? Was it all, yeah, worth it? And I mean, intuitively, I can probably say it's not. They would probably do so many more things differently. Even the ones that live, you know, forever. Look at Betty White is the greatest one. Like, she was so, but she didn't, I mean, she just didn't go into all of that. I mean, she took care of herself. She had the money and stuff, but she was, didn't look, I mean, she looked old.
Yeah.
You know, yeah, she seemed to embrace who she was and just took that and ran with it. And that's who she became. And everyone loved her. Almost everyone, yeah, loved her. Yeah.
Exactly. And she lived till almost 100.
She did. You know? And she seemed happy.
Yes, exactly. So, you know, so it's just, it's interesting, like, the people we put put up on pedestals in the type of way we think we're supposed to live. But maybe it's really more about learning how to appreciate and come into our own bodies. That's what intuitive eating is about, is turning off all the noise out there and instead learning how to listen to what your own body is saying. And because nobody knows, I mean, this kind of minimizes it to a little bit extent, but nobody knows how hungry or full you are, what's going to be satisfying for you except for you.
Yeah.
And so if somebody were to tell you that you could only have so much of this, you know, well, what if you're not necessarily particularly hungry at that moment, or maybe you're more hungry than that, but now you think, oh, I'm only allowed this much. And then your body starts fighting back and saying, hey, wait a minute, I'm starving, go get me food, you know?
Yeah.
And then we actually go into this cycle that happens. It's this restriction binge cycle. So where it starts is that we have some sort of rule about the food, whether it's the type, the amount, or when we're allowed to have it. Could be a combination of these. But there's some sort of rule that's in place. And then the deprivation starts building up. And it could be a fast buildup. It could be over time. But it gets to this place where we feel like we just can't take it anymore. And that's when we might eat quickly. We might eat to a place of uncomfortable fullness. And then we get the guilt and the shame for breaking the initial rules. And then the cycle starts all over again. And it just keeps going and going and going. And where most people feel like the issue is with the eating out of control aspect, the actual thing where it starts is the rules. Oh. Because we usually set these unrealistic expectations for ourselves, like, oh, I'm never going to eat chocolate ever again, or, oh, I can only have that once a month, or whatever the case might be. And if those rules weren't in place, then chances are the rest of that cycle wouldn't happen, you know? And the fact of the matter is that it doesn't mean that we can't enjoy those different things. It doesn't mean, you know, we're technically not out of control. It's just our bodies is kind of rebelling back from those limitations. So I have this funny example too. Like, let's say that you were walking past a wall that was boring, didn't have anything on it, and you really didn't pay it any sort of mind at all. It was just a wall. It helped hold up the building, whatever.
Yeah.
Well, one day somebody puts a really big red button on that wall and then puts a sign next to that button and says, you can't touch this button. What are you going to think? That this wall that you just kept walking by all the time, that you thought nothing about, now all of a sudden it's really interesting because there's this really big red button and a sign that says don't touch it. And then when you do touch it, it's like this really cool thing that happens. Like, you get this confetti and fun music and balloons, and it's a really fun experience, you know? Yeah. And but you're not supposed to touch it. So, of course, what's going to happen? You're going to want to touch it, right?
Yeah.
And you're going to, like, feel like, oh, I want to keep pushing it.
You're obsessed over it.
Exactly. And so if that wasn't even there in the first place, chances are that wouldn't have been a big deal to you. And so that's kind of like how I think about this with our food and with our body, is that it's these limitations that we put onto ourselves that make that seem like we have a sense of control, but it ends up making us feel more out of control. And once our body recognizes that we have access to it and that we can enjoy it in whatever amount feels good for our bodies or whatever, then all of a sudden it takes that power out of that food. And it's still going to be delicious. You might still like having it, but you're not necessarily going to be like, oh my God, I can't get enough of it, you know?
Yeah, it creates moderation within yourself.
Yeah, in a way. And sometimes moderation can feel kind of restrictive in a way, mm-hmm. because it feels there's still a sense of how much you're allowed to have of that. But in a way, your body does figure out what it needs at that moment. And that might be different from moment to moment. Yeah. Doesn't mean that that's wrong. It just means that's what your body needed at that time, you know? Yeah. So,
yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. So, yeah. So anyways, I could keep talking and talking and talking.
I love it. Love it. Love it. So this, speaking of improving body image and self-worth, is a significant part of your work, as we've spoken about. What are some initial steps people can start to take to improve their body image and recognize their inherent worth?
Well, for one thing, I'm going to say this is a process. All of this stuff that I'm talking about is a process. As much as like diet culture likes to instill like, oh, this is good. This could happen in this X amount of time or whatever. And you could snap your fingers and do all of this. This is a process. We've had decades of messaging put into our head, and we still receive messaging to this day multiple times a day. And it takes some time to kind of sort through that and to be able to get to that place where you feel more comfortable.
Yeah.
What I would also say is that asking yourself to be best friends with your body when you've hated your body for a long time is a lot to ask. Yeah. And it doesn't mean that it can't happen, but it means it kind of can feel like a goal, like you're shooting for the moon. And if you don't get to the moon, then you feel like you haven't done anything. But instead, what I work on with people is taking baby steps towards hating your body a little bit less every time, and maybe working towards neutrality where you can coexist with your body. Maybe you're not best friends, but at least you can come to a place of coexisting and things like that, and not feeling like you need to take up less space to feel a certain type of way. And it is a process. It is a process. I wish it were a light switch and we could just flip it and then all of a sudden we feel a certain way. But it is, because we get all of these things that make us feel a certain type of way, or we see things, or people say things, and it really can hit us to our core. And it's a matter of healing that core, that vulnerable person inside, who's really hurt by all of that, and that's a process. So I would say, as a step to take towards that, have some words that I always end up falling back on throughout my whole counseling is having some objective curiosity and some compassion. Because I find that when we sit there and we're watching things happen, or like whether it's how we're eating something or what our bodies look like or whatever the case is, that mean inner critic likes to come out and be a bully and judge us for whatever happens. And if instead what we can try to do, of course, that bully is still going to be there because that's what her job is. Right. But it doesn't mean she's going to have that job for much longer. But But if we can come from a place of innocent curiosity, where we're just kind of watching and observing and seeing what's happening without the judgment piece in there, it really opens up the bigger picture of everything that's happening and offers us room for compassion and flexibility and coming up with like ways of supporting, as opposed to that judgment piece, that inner critic. Whenever I feel like my inner critic is taking over, I just kind of want to curl up in a ball and like forget everything, right?
Yeah.
But the innocent curiosity without that judgment piece attached to it really opens things up and gives us that room to just find out what's going on and how to best support ourselves, you know?
Yeah. And looking at, to me, it's always like looking at my body, like my body does all this cool stuff. Like it functions and I don't even have to think about it. Like my arms are moving. I'm thinking, but I'm not thinking about moving my arms right now. But they're able to move and they're able to do things. They're able to pick things up. They're able to do, you know, they're not, you know, I could look at all the flab that's here or whatever, or I can like, this is really cool. My arm literally is functioning here to pick something up for me or to do things to make me functionable and to make me more or productive or whatever, to make my life more joyful.
Yeah, exactly. And another thing that you can also think about with your arms too, is like, do you have any animals or any kids or things like that?
I have a dog, yes.
Okay.
She's like my kid. I do have kids, but yeah, she's my...
Okay. So when you go and you snuggle with your dog or your kids or whatever, your arms help you to be able to do that. And you know what? Your dog and your kids, they love how your arms feel.
Yeah.
You know, they love that warmth and that softness and that point of connection and things like that. And they wouldn't change it in any bit or any way, because that's what your arms bring you. And so taking step towards like that gratitude and appreciation of your body can also help towards how you feel about it, as opposed to sitting there and you know, belittling every little piece of your body that you might not like. But the function piece is not necessarily like just trying to sit there and like say, it's a good step. It's a good step, but just also recognizing too that as much as we can recognize those things that our bodies can do, there can still be a lot of pain that we hold with our body, because we can hold these definitions of what that means about us and what our worth is, what our value, what our health is, that's not necessarily true. And it takes time to be able to work through all of that. So giving yourself that room to breathe and have compassion is important.
Yeah, absolutely. So joyful movement is a refreshing concept in a world where exercise is often seen as punishment or obligation. How do you encourage clients to find forms of movement they genuinely enjoy?
Yeah. And I definitely resonate with that whole punishment aspect, because I definitely used a lot of exercise as punishment. Even growing up, like, I hated PE growing up. It was just not my thing, because I'm far from athletic. And sports is just not my favorite. But but even like if there were things that I thought were more doable, like maybe dance classes or things like that, I still always would take it to the punishment level. And so in answer to your question, we do switch that language around what exercise is, that instead of focusing it as a way of trying to adjust the scale or things of that sort, instead the movement is more about helping your body feel good or help it function easier. And because there's so many different things that movement can do for our bodies. Like, for example, it can be a great stress reliever. It can be a, it can help you go to the bathroom. It can help regulate blood sugars. It can help your heart beat easier. All of these different things and more. But if we get so hunkered down to trying to adjust the scale, or our body size or whatever the case might be, then if that doesn't cooperate the way that we want it to, then we think all of the exercise is worthless, you know?
Yeah.
And we might stop doing it because of that. And so in answer to your question, about like, how do you pick something that has that joyful movement aspect to it? First, what I would say is that even though with any of the principles of intuitive eating, you could kind of do them in whatever order you like, I personally find that if we jump right towards joyful movement and gentle nutrition, it really can easily turn into that same way that we would diet, and you know, it would be rules and things like that. So first, you know, working on our relationship with food and body and movement, mm-hmm. and going through those earlier principles, that can help you approach joyful movement in a different kind of light. But kind of thinking of that in that sense, but also when we get to that point of thinking about different things that we like, what is it that you have fun doing? How do you like to spend your time? For me, my favorite joyful movement is swing dancing.
Ooh, that sounds fun.
It is. It's very fun. I love swing dancing. And, you know, because when I'm there, I'm listening to the music, I'm having fun with my partner, I'm doing the steps, and, you know, and it's all just about the experience. It's all just focusing on the whole entire thing. I'm not worried about what my heart rate is. I'm not worried about, you know, am I burning XYZ? I'm just having a good time and enjoying and being with people and stuff like that. And like transforming to that time period and everything, you know, that's what that's all about. And that's what joyful movement is. And it might be that for some folks, it might be going on a stroll through a local wildlife preserve, and you can walk through and look at all of that, or hiking through some sort of mountains, if that's, you know, seeing all of those beautiful mountain ranges and trees and animals and all of that is something that, you know, lights you up, then that's your joyful movement. And of course you can always have more than one, but you know, but if you're sitting there and let's say when I was in the height of my eating disorder and I was trying to push myself with that, this was the picture. First of all, I hated really going to the gym. The gym is just boring to me.
Understandable.
Yes, very boring. And the place that I was going to, the where they had the TVs and stuff, like the machine that was kind of the least resistant to me, like I could tolerate that, I could it wasn't as bad as the other things that I didn't like at the gym. It was the elliptical. That was the one that I hated the least, I would say.
Understand.
And all of the TVs that were there were on things that I really hated watching. You know, it was all like stressful news and
yes, why do they do that?
Yeah, exactly. Like, put on something fun.
Like the news or some talk show, something is like people arguing.
Yes, exactly. So I'd end up like focusing on the panel that was in front of me with all the numbers on it, and that's why I got caught up with that heart rate part of it.
Yeah.
And I was focused on that, and that of course got boring after a while. I try to bring like things to read, but of course you're bouncing around, and so the
That's
numbers
definitely so hard to read on an elliptical.
are yes. So it was just. And I was pushing myself to levels that weren't safe for my body. So after I was getting off, I was feeling very tired. And so I was tired, I was bored. And I was pushing myself to these limits, and it just wasn't, it was like the least of joyful possible. And I got burnt out on it. It even got to the point where I would drive to the gym and I'd sit in the parking lot staring at the gym, trying to
Wow.
coerce myself to go inside. And there were times that I couldn't coerce myself and I just started the car back up and left. And because I it was torture to go in there and do this kind of stuff. So with that being said, this is joyful movement is instead about having fun and helping your body feel good, and being gentle with yourself, because people also have they have these shoulds in their head about that, and like what it's supposed to look like, what level we're supposed to be at. But understanding that people have varying degrees of mobility, and that doesn't mean that you have to get to this level in order to be worthwhile or healthy or whatever, that even just moving your body gently in some type of way for a 5 minutes, that could be what your body's able to tolerate and what you might have the mental capacity for that day, and that's still okay, you know?
Yeah.
So that's what that joyful movement piece is about.
I love that. That's to be so inspirational, especially people who are not, I mean, I have half my friends are like gym, oh, they're very like motivated workout body, you know, not half my friends, some of my friends, builder, you know, and I'm like, I love that about them. I do go to the gym, but it's just to get it out of the way. But then I also incorporate so many more things of for joyfulness. In it,
Yeah.
yeah, as well.
Definitely. And you know what? And it would be okay too, is if you gave yourself permission to not feel forced to go to the gym. You know,
I do
I
enjoy it
mean,
though. So I mean, it's not that I do the things that I enjoy there now, as opposed to
okay.
10 years ago. I don't do the elliptical. I don't do the cardio stuff. I don't enjoy it. I do enough to warm up, but I don't enjoy it. I don't have to
Yeah.
do that. I get enough exercise, enough. I'm fidgeting enough all day long anyway
Right, exactly.
to get that up. So yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah. So I want to leave our listeners with one more question for you.
Sure.
For someone listening who feels overwhelmed by the pressures of diet culture and struggling with their relationship with food and their bodies, what advice would you give to help them start a path towards healing and self-acceptance?
First of all, taking a deep breath, because that's a lot right there to tackle, and it is possible, but also giving yourself permission to not feel like an expert with it all, right off the
That.
bat, you
Yeah.
know, or even 6 months down the road with it, you know, it's a process. Even while I was I felt in my brain, of course, my inner critic when I was just learning about intuitive eating and things like that, I was like, oh, well, you know what? I'm a dietitian. This should be old hat to me. I should be able to, you hear the shoulds coming out of me. I should be able to help people and myself at the same
Yeah.
time. But guess what? You know what? 6 months after I became certified, I still was fresh in my journey. I was still trying to figure things out and how to reframe and how to recognize things, how to be able to tackle it, and also learning how to counsel people at the same time on these things. And it was definitely a process for those things combined, but even just doing my own thing by myself. So giving yourself the room to breathe and recognizing this as a process is a really big part of that. And it doesn't mean that it can't happen. It's just our instant gratification might need to take a step to the side, you know? And it's not about a destination. It's not about getting to this place of feeling like you've arrived. But it's really more about everything that you learn along the way that helps you grow, helps you reconnect with yourself and learn more about you. And so also realizing that those steps are really important along the process rather than feeling like you'd have to get to a certain place, you know, by a certain time.
It's just a lifelong journey. And enjoying each step too. I think that's important to add in, for me personally, to add in, like, enjoying the step, the process of this, because you're learning about your body. You're learning who you are.
Yeah, exactly. I've learned so much more about myself in this whole process than I've ever learned before this. And so, yeah, it's been an incredible, incredible journey. And I'm still learning. I'm still having moments that can be more challenging than others, like especially if I'm feeling especially vulnerable, like if I'm tired or if I'm dealing with like a not a typical amount of stress that I would normally have to deal with, or if, you know, things that from my past, they come back to haunt me in some way. You know, sometimes that inner critic loves having field days in my head, and I have the strategies and stuff to kind of come back though. And so being able to have that grace and that flexibility and that compassion really helps that along. Awesome. So, yeah.
Well, thank you so much for sharing your story with us. Yeah. Your incredible story.
Thank you.
Incredible knowledge here. If anyone, my listeners, want to connect with Jenna, her stuff is going to be in the show notes. Reach out to her. I'm sure she'll do consultations for you. She'll hook you up with all kinds of cool stuff, knowledge that to further your long, not diet journey, but your health journey.
Yeah, exactly. And I have this really cool thing. Right now, I just signed up with this company called Berry Street, and it's they accept different insurance companies there. So, so I can do one-on-one counseling with people, and a majority of those people get those appointments for free or for a lower cost or whatever. And it's really neat. And we can dive into all of this stuff on people's individual journeys. So really cool. So that link will be on the show notes.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, thank you again so much.
You're very welcome.